Flint, Michigan, and its problem with lead in the water supply got a lot of people thinking about what's in our water, and a lot more testing has gone on since the Flint situation arose. Some of the testing has found lead in water supplies for a variety of reasons. It's turned up in Portland schools, Eugene schools, and the city of Medford. It can be caused by lead pipes still in use, by brass fittings and plumbing fixtures, and other environmental causes. We'll spend much of this hour talking about lead, why it's there, and what we can do about it with three guests. Dr. James Shames is Jackson County Health and Human Services Medical Director, back in the studio with us once again. Jim, good to have you back here.
Thanks, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Also in the studio with me with some knowledge of soil and why lead occurs in the environment, Richard Roseberg, who is the director at Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center here and after, usually known as SOREC. Welcome, Rich.
Good morning. Thank you.
And on the line from Eugene, we have Dr. Lauren Herbert, also an MD, pediatrician, and a board member of the group Beyond Toxic. So she has a couple of hats she can wear here. Dr. Herbert, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So I want to come to Rich Roseberg first and tell us a bit about the basic outline of where lead occurs naturally.
Yeah, naturally lead is found as a trace mineral in rocks in the Earth's crust and in the soils that are derived from that crust. So typically in a typical soil, it's on the order of 10, 20, 30, 40 parts per million, that kind of a concentration just naturally occurring. It does not have any particular function in plants. It's not required. It's not a required plant nutrient, certainly not a required human nutrient. So it's just kind of there in the background in most cases. If we see elevated levels in the environment, it's almost always due to some kind of human activity, lead smelting, lead processing, or deposition of some product that has lead as an ingredient, whether it's paint or in the old days lead-based lead ingredients in gasoline. Those kinds of things almost always indicate some kind of human involvement if there's elevated levels.
You're generally not going to see any concentrations then unless somebody's been around to disturb the lead.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. And concentrated in some way by some activity.
So, for example, if it is not present in the water supply per se, if the water that's getting into the pipes doesn't have any background lead in it, is it likely then a plumbing issue?
That's often the case. If the water coming out of the ground, the well, the aquifer, whatever, gets into a system where it can dissolve the lead, out of the pipes or whatever is going on, then it can become soluble and be in the water that way. And even that doesn't always necessarily happen. It depends a little bit on the pH, the acidity of that water. The more acid the water is, the more it's going to dissolve the lead out of the pipes or whatever it's coming in contact with.
Oh, so different kinds of water will have different capacities to bring the lead out of whatever is carrying it.
Correct.
Okay. Dr. Jim Shames, it seems like it's every day some school district or other entity tests for lead and finds it either in a water fountain in a school building. In fact, there's one here on the campus of Southern Oregon University about a block away that showed up one. They got the Medford Water System, the Medford Water Commission showing up lead pigtail pipes, which we'll discuss at a little length further on. But from your view as a health officer, I mean, what's going on? Give us a general idea of the sense of what you're dealing with on your end of things.
Sure. Well, lead is toxic, and it's especially toxic to infants and young children who have a more porous blood-brain barrier, so to speak, and who absorb the lead more quickly than adults. So it's a real problem if lead gets into the system of children. They can't get rid of it, gets stored in the bones, gets stored in the teeth, and it's a neurotoxic. So that's the problem. The good news is we've made tremendous progress from a public health perspective, getting lead out of gasoline, getting lead out of paint, and so there's a lot less lead exposure. The problem is, of course, there's no safe level of lead. So small amounts of lead in the environment, small amounts of lead in the dust, small amounts of lead in the water is unacceptable. So that's the public health perspective. We've made tremendous progress, but we need to identify where the lead is and remove it.
It seems like at this point, most of what's going on within Jackson County with the Medford Water Commission taking the lead, since it does serve so many communities, that it is sort of the owners of the pipes dealing with this more than the health department. Is there health department involvement at this point, Health and Human Services?
Well, we're always there. I mean, we're there in the background. We're there to help advise. We're there to, if there are elevated blood lead levels in children, we will receive that information, and then we can then provide advice. But yes, you're correct. The owners of the pipes are the people that ultimately are going to have to figure out what's going on and solve the problem.
Led the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Jim Shames from Jackson County Health and Human Services, Richard Roseberg from the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, and we're about to hear from Dr. Lauren Herbert, a pediatrician and a board member at Beyond Toxics. You can join this discussion. You may have lots of questions about lead and what to do about it if it happens to turn up in your own water supply and how to find it, for that matter, in the first place. 800-838-3760, the phone number here on the Exchange to join the discussion. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Lauren Herbert, I understand that that early in your career you worked in a place where kids were showing up a fair amount with lead in their systems. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I've been in practice for 26 years now, or been a pediatrician for 26 years. And when I was doing my residency at Oakland Children's Hospital, there was still quite a bit of lead. And that's still true, that the kids that are poorer and living in poor housing are more apt to have elevated lead levels, partly because of the lead in the paint, partly because sometimes the housing is located near places where there's been, lead gasoline exposure. So at Oakland Children's Hospital, we screened all the children for elevated lead levels, and we did have some that were elevated. And I recall having, hospitalizing one kid and trying to chelate that child. I think that's kind of fallen out of favor just because it's not very effective and you're just getting the lead out of the blood and not addressing the bone stores. But I think during the time that I practiced, it's the lead levels have actually fallen quite a bit in children. Moving back to Oregon, we still screen for lead in high-risk children, but it's no longer the universal screening that we did when I was at Oakland Children's Hospital.
You mentioned chelating lead. I've heard of this process. It's spelled with a CH, isn't it? It looks like chelate. Is that the process we're talking about?
Yeah, and that's really fallen out of favor. That was something that was done with really high levels of lead, and we don't even see the... So I think there was one child during the 3 years that I was at Oakland Children's Hospital that we did that. I think that was, there used to be really high lead levels, I think, in past that I never saw, where there were kids that had lead encephalopathy, and then it makes sense to do, the chelation or chelation, whichever you, however you pronounce it. But that's really doesn't make sense for the low levels of lead that we now see. So it used to be that I think that elevated lead levels were considered over 10 micrograms per deciliter, and now it's the screening level elevated lead levels are considered above 5 micrograms per deciliter, but that there's actually no safe level lead level. So. But it's those when I do see a child that has an elevated lead level, I'm not thinking about chelation or chelation at all. I'm thinking about what's in the environment. How do we make changes in their environment to eliminate any lead exposure?
Jim Shames, the advantage of having you in the studio is I can see you nod. So you were relating to the chelation discussion. I mean, have you seen this process go on before?
It makes sense, and yet it doesn't seem to affect. As she was saying, that it doesn't seem to really take care of the blood stores, the
bone and stores. Stores.
Right, exactly. So it has fallen out of favor.
So just in general, once lead is in the body, what are some of the options for people who would like to see it get out, and how much damage has already been done that can't be undone by removing lead from the body?
Well, that is the problem. This is an environmental issue. You've got to get rid of the source of lead. So if you have a child with elevated blood lead levels, and as Dr. Herbert was saying, we have identified, first it was 15 micrograms, and then it was 10 micrograms, now it's 5 micrograms. What we realize is there is no level of acceptable lead in the body. So you've got to say, where's that lead coming from? And you've got to get rid of the source, whether it be the lead paint or the lead dust or the lead in the soil or the industrial exposure.
Rich Roseberg, you seem to be leaning forward like there's something that striking your fancy here.
Just to clarify one point about the dust that was brought up, and certainly ingestion is the key, whether it's dissolved in water or some other way, but inhalation of dust where lead has contaminated the soil. That certainly is an issue. So that can occur when there are residues from lead gasoline or lead-based paints. But in areas like ours that have a long history of orchard agriculture, whether it's apples or pears or other types of orchards, a material, lead arsenate, was used as an insecticide from the early 1900s up to about 1950 or so. It was phased out, and both lead and arsenic are not good things to be ingesting. It's quite an effective insecticide. It was replaced, ironically, by DDT when that came out, which also has its problems. But once lead is in the soil, it remains in the soil. It's immobile. It tends to not dissolve and leach out. It tends to remain there, which is not a big problem in terms of plant uptake. It does not accumulate typically in plants by being brought in through the roots and so on and so forth. But the main issue is the dust, as was inferred, either if you have bare soil or dust that gets on the plants. So you can imagine a situation if you have a field that used to be an orchard and lead arsenate was applied for many years, the lead is still attached to the dust, fairly inert in that stage. But if a child is playing in the dust, or if the soil is disturbed and the dust becomes airborne, then that lead can be inhaled by a child or an adult, whoever, and that's where it becomes an issue. So mitigating that lead level in the dust from old orchards is certainly something that we're aware of here in the Rogue Valley, and that's not unique to us. It's true of anywhere where there was extensive orchard agriculture in the early 1900s.
So how different can the levels be between an area that was an orchard or maybe still be an orchard and the soil concentration of lead there versus neighboring property that was never used for that purpose?
Typical background soil might be 40 parts per million. Orchards can be, old orchards can be several hundred parts per million, sometimes 1 or 2,000 parts per million. It just depends on how much that soil has been mixed over the years or whether it's been relatively undisturbed. So you could have a concentrated layer of a few inches thick that is fairly high, and then immediately below that have fairly low levels. It just kind of depends on the history of how that property was managed.
So when we talk about ingestion, which implies getting it and swallowing, and can it also be breathed in?
Inhalation. In the case of dust, inhalation is the primary issue.
Okay, we're talking about lead here in the Jefferson Exchange with a couple of people who know about the lead and where it is found. Richard Roseberg is from the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center. Lauren Herbert is a pediatrician in Eugene and a member of the board of Beyond Toxics. And Jim Shames is with us in the studio as well. He is the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. Join the discussion. You probably have lots of questions and maybe a few stories to share as well. We would like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 is the phone number here. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm coming to the conversation late, but I'm a paint and plaster contractor in the Valley, and I'm certified for lead renovation work on pre-1978 homes. And I wanted to say that I found it, I'll just say interesting, I'll use that even though I'm cynical about it, that the lead rules, the new lead rules, private landowners and commercial entities were quickly exempted from that new law. And I just wanted to point that out, that as serious as we recognize lead ingestion is for, it is the number one health hazard for kids in the state, and if you've said that already, I apologize for repeating it. But I just find it disappointing, really, that we would just simply exempt commercial entities as well as private landowners. They can go out and blow all that loose lead paint off of their home onto the ground and walk away from it, and that's it.
There's no disposal requirement?
They are exempt from the lead law, the lead renovation rules.
Interesting. So Derek, since you're involved in the business, let me ask you a couple of questions. And in lead renovation, basically, is any home post-1978 going to have lead paint in it, likely, if it was built after that year?
Well, you mean pre-78, and the answer is not necessarily, but very often prior to 78, it will have it. And there's testing protocols for us to test it. But again, if you're a homeowner, you're not subject to those. And if you're a commercial entity, you can just go and perform the work the way that we did it prior to the new lead rules, and that is essentially much more careless, to be quite honest.
All right. So, but any home built since 1978 is not going to have lead paint in it. Is that correct?
No, well, that's not necessarily true either. Just that's why you have to check, because the lead paint was also on shelves for a while, mm-hmm. and so I'd find an occasional, you know, 79 or 80 home that they were still using that, and so that's why there's testing requirements.
Okay. Thanks for the perspective, Derek. Appreciate that. Any thoughts from anybody at the table about the regulations on that?
I have a house built in 1924. And it has shakes on the sides. It's been repainted twice, and the last time we tested for lead, and the lead had penetrated into the shakes, and it still tests positive.
Really? So yeah. You could remove the paint and still would have gotten into the...
It just means that the next layer of paint that peels off probably has lead in it.
Well, okay, so it's definitely things for people to look out for in older houses. We should talk, too, about the kinds of stuff that will end up bringing lead into the water supply in your house, and this discussion of pigtails has been a big one for the Medford Water Commission of late, where the main lines in the street are not lead, the lines in the house generally are not lead, but what connects the two, that short connector from the service line to the water meter is often made of lead, and it was done simply because lead is so pliable, it's flexible. So I guess there's a process they're going through. The Medford Water Commission puts out a pretty good map. If you get your water in Medford from the Water Commission, there's a very good map at their website that shows where there might be some concerns. And it's generally the older part of Medford where these lead pigtails exist. What do you know about testing, Jim Shames, for people who want to find out if there's any lead in their water?
Well, we have private certified labs where you can send your water. And the mechanism is you fill up a liter container first thing in the morning with cold water, so the water's been sitting in the pipes. You send it out, and they'll give you the parts per billion. And then at that point, if you have lead in the water, you're going to have to do some detective work to see what it is.
Now, I have heard some recommendations, too, that if you at least run your water until it's cold, that you'll be clearing out the stuff that's been sitting in the lines. And I guess for some reason that when the water is sitting there longer in older pipes and fixtures, you know, the lead can accumulate. Is this something you're aware of, Richard Roseberg?
Yeah, it's just a matter of how long the water is in contact with the lead material, whether it's the solder or the pigtail or whatever. It's just sitting there motionless for several hours. It's going to gradually dissolve lead into that small volume of water. So by flushing it, you're removing all that and reducing the contact time of the water you're actually drinking or using.
Dr. Lauren Herbert, I want to come back to you wearing your hat from Beyond Toxics. I want to know, just on the list of things that are concerns for your group around Oregon, how where lead ranks on that list.
Well, I think there are a lot of other environmental health concerns as well. And I know, I'm also on the American Academy of Pediatrics. There's a section on environmental health. And at one of the AAP meetings, American Academy of Pediatric meetings a couple of years ago, I went to that section and was kind of frustrated that they talked about lead, and then I can't remember what the other talk was on. There's only two talks in that section. And I was thinking, well, what about climate change? What about pesticide exposure? What about herbicide? There's all these other environmental health risks. There's a lot of them. And why aren't we talking about this? I think there are a lot of other environmental health issues. I think lead remains an environmental health issue, one we need to pay attention to, but I think that there are many other emerging and growing environmental health issues that share some of the same story. And I think that's one of the things that's concerning. Lead is a known neurotoxin. When it was introduced maybe Jim or Rich can tell more about this, but it was an anti-knock agent in gasoline or something, and I'm not sure why it was in paint. Somebody else probably knows much more about that than I, but it was a known neurotoxin and should never have been in those products in the first place. And then I think that there was a lot of uncertainty about measurement techniques, and really before, I think to be able to, it was only after multiple study proved that there's actually problems with development in kids and behavioral problems that people actually began to take it seriously and pass legislation that would remove lead from gasoline and paint and I think and other products too. But I think it's I think the same thing is happening in other areas like some other environmental toxins that have some not great evidence of health problems, but there's really pretty good evidence of health problems. And to me, I feel like if there's that strong possibility of there being health problems with these products, that we should err on the side of safety and try to remove those products from so that children aren't exposed to those products.
Instead of waiting decades, as we did with lead.
Exactly, exactly. And then, but I think that there's, I think when there's economic, there's some people profiting from having those products in the environment, then is it their economic benefit to be able to just point out the uncertainty of uncertainties when it's, when really there's a probability, the probability, overriding probability is there's problems with these toxic substances or with climate change.
All right. You'd like to see quicker action for sure. Rich Roseburg, it seems like lead in the ways in which it was used that Lauren Herbert just described, it was often just sort of an enhancement. I mean, it made gasoline not knock. I guess it makes paint colors more vivid. Is that the general use of lead over the years?
Right. That's the general idea. It's lead is... In an industrial sense, lead is cheap. It's a cheap ingredient, and by using it in tetraethyl lead in gasoline or as a color enhancement in paint and so on, it's just a cheaper way to achieve the improvement in the octane or the improvement in the color of the paint. And it's a flexible. So if you think about you're a plumber or something back in the early 1900s, you don't have plastics and things to use. So if you're connecting pipes and need something flexible, lead is a cheap, flexible material to use.
All right. The listeners can hear the music. That does not mean the lead discussion is going to end, though. We'll carry it through the break, and we'll take a short break now and come back and talk more with Rich Roseburg, Jim Shames, and Lauren Herbert about lead in the environment and the things that we need to look out for. We can take more phone calls and emails. Have a couple waiting. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're continuing a discussion about lead because lead continues to show up in tests of water supplies around the region. It's shown up in Portland schools. It's shown up in a couple of facilities in Southern Oregon. It has shown up in the Medford water system caused by old lead pigtails to connect city system water to houses. It's turning up in a lot of places. So we have a couple of guests to help us understand why it's there and what it can do to us. Dr. Lauren Herbert is a pediatrician, board member of Beyond Toxics, on the line from Eugene. Dr. Richard Roseburg, PhD, is with the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center, the director. He is a soil scientist, knows a lot about environmental lead. And Jim Shames is the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Lisa in Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. It was recently reported in the Oregonian that Governor Brown is calling for school districts to test and reveal their findings. And I noticed in the article there's a statement by the Oregon School Boards Association that they're worried about the cost and cost of testing, cost of mitigation. I wondered if the speakers could talk about incentives to get these problems fixed, because all of them have agreed that we have to get lead out of the environment. Like, why couldn't there be tax incentives for homeowners or owners of rental properties to get lead out of pipes? And how can our state do more to help us solve the problem?
Okay, I think this is Lisa Arkin, isn't it?
Yes,
that
thank
Lisa,
you.
Okay, from Beyond Toxics. Okay, so either one of you have any knowledge of that? This sounds like a little bit outside your realm of expertise at the table, certainly, about tax incentives and... Okay, I'm getting blank stares here. Lauren Herbert, you're also on Beyond Toxic, so you probably know something about what's available.
No, I don't know anything about tax incentives about that or any other so I would defer to Lisa about that.
Okay. We actually had, I should explain, too, that in the process of trying to organize a program to talk about lead, we did find a few people who were a little shy of the issue. Water systems in particular, a lot of handing off, like, well, we can talk about this later, or maybe this is the better person to talk to, that kind of situation. So that's why we don't have people who are really knowledgeable about the lead pipes, for example, right here at the table with us today. Boyd in Wolf Creek wrote in and said, how much lead remains around highways from exhaust emissions long after it was banned from gasoline? Is that something you might know about, Rich Rosenberg?
Yeah, from the tetraethyl lead that was used for decades. Lead is, once it gets into the soil, it tends to attach very strongly to the soil. It tends to be immobile. So if the soil near highways where, you know, the exhausts were deposited are not disturbed, the lead is going to remain there in the top, top couple, 3 inches of soil. Pretty much indefinitely, in the sense that it's not mobile, it does not dissolve or leach readily.
Is that because it is so heavy? It is such a heavy, it just sits there and remains where it is.
It's a transition metal. It's a positively charged ion. If you think back to the periodic table in your high school or college chemistry, it's one of those elements in the middle, transition metal that has different charges depending on the environment. But it tends to be, because of the positive charge and because of the size of the ion, it tends to be strongly attracted to soil particles, especially clay-sized soil particles, and tends not to dissolve unless there's an acid, more of an acid water. So for that reason, it would not surprise me, in fact, that lead levels would be continue to be high near highways if the soil's not been disturbed.
Okay, Jim Shames?
So this is an excellent example of the social determinants of health, or the disparities we see in racial and economic groups. Kids that live near highways are still exposed to lead, and those tend to be people of color and people who are economically disadvantaged. So that, you know, even though we've made great progress, we still have to focus on those groups. That's one of the reasons that lead testing is recommended for lower-income kids, kids living, you know, near major thoroughfares, because the lead still may be in the soil, and people who live in older houses with potential lead exposure from peeling paint.
Let's talk about testing then. If people think that there's exposure, should they be testing their water, their soil, themselves? What are the logical steps here, Jim Shames?
Well, ultimately testing themselves is the final determinant. I mean, you could have lead in the environment, and if you're not exposing yourself, then you don't have a problem. So I think testing children who may be potentially at risk is the way to start. You would do a finger stick test. If that was positive, you'd then do a venous puncture to get a real, true, accurate measurement, and then you can do mitigation from that point.
So let's talk about the mitigation, Lauren Herbert. If a child does have lead in the body, what can be done?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that we do screen kids for lead. So usually when the kids come in for well visits at 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months, you know, and then every year until six, we have a lead questionnaire. And then if there are any positive answers on that, then we ask more to find out the details of that and then screen the children. And then if we do have, and most of those are, we'll have the positive screens, and most of those kids have undetectable lead levels. So, but still, that's the way we're going to detect those kids that really are having significant lead exposure. And then once we, if we detect kids that have lead exposure, we talk to the parents about it and contact public health, and public health then is helpful in trying to help.
Lauren Herbert, if lead has been in the body and has caused some developmental delays, can the child catch up later, or is this a lifelong thing?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's a lifelong thing. It's the thing is, though, that you don't see, like, I've had individuals with elevated lead levels, and they seem developmentally perfectly normal, because, you know, development has so many different aspects of and so many different influences. So I think it's really more on the epidemiologic, the population studies where you do, that they're able to detect those developmental differences. So it's not with any individual. So I can you know, I can think of one little girl that had 30 micrograms per deciliter lead level or so, and she was perfectly fine developmentally. And maybe she would have been even smarter if she hadn't had that. I don't know. But it just, there's so, it's really more on the population levels that you see those difference in development and neurologic differences rather than any specific patient.
Okay, let's take a call. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about lead.
Good morning. I used to blend a lot of fertilizer here in the Rogue Valley when I was working my way through college, and we would have people who would come in asking about hot spots in their yards, and it turned out that was usually arsenic that had been used in foliar applications and then somehow concentrated in the surface soil as the orchards were built over. And what we would recommend and what seemed to work then was the application of gypsum to bind up the arsenic and carry it away. I guess you've got a soil scientist on today, so maybe he could comment on that and whether that would also work with soil-based lead.
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it. Rich?
Yeah, he's talking about the lead arsenate that was sprayed for insecticides in the orchards, as I mentioned earlier. Yeah, the arsenic will be in the arsenate form, which is similar sort of chemically to sulfate in the gypsum. Gypsum is calcium sulfate. So it's more what he's describing of removing arsenate is exchanging the sulfur, adding sulfur, and sort of displacing the arsenate into the solution and then ultimately leached out of the system. So that's what he's talking about. Lead lead will not behave the same way. In fact, usually the mitigation methods for lead, if it's whether it's from old orchards or other sources, is to immobilize it and to minimize contact, human contact, so it can be immobilized. It's attached to clay particles, as I mentioned. It also binds strongly to organic matter particles, and it also becomes immobile in pHs that are closer to neutral. In other words, not acid soils. You want to neutralize those soils. In all those situations, the lead, it's not removed from the system, but it becomes more or less inert. So as long as we avoid contact, avoid dust, getting into the air and being inhaled by people, then it's pretty safe under those conditions. But minimizing the contact is the key.
Will edible crops grown in lead-based soil not bear any lead above detectable or actionable levels?
Yeah. Crops do not take up lead particularly. They don't concentrate it. They don't need it. They don't tend to take it up. So if you're eating, if you're eating the produce off of the tree, or the beans you grow in your garden, that kind of thing, the lead is not going to be inside the crop in any appreciable quantity. The danger is if there is lead in the soil and the soil is on the outside of the crop, you know, lettuce or kohlrabi or anything like that that you would eat, then if the dust is on the outside of the plant part that you're eating, then it can be a problem. And so it needs to be thoroughly washed and removed under those conditions.
Now, will the same places that will test your water for lead also test soil for lead? Like for Nielsen Labs in Medford is the one always listed in Jackson County.
Yeah, typically an environmental lab, they'll test soil, they'll test water, they'll test plant parts if you want.
Okay, so the big thing is, I guess it's on the homeowner to go ahead and test water, in particular, Jim Shames.
Yes, I believe that's true.
Okay, so check with the lab near you. $30 is a figure I saw bandied about this morning from Nielsen Labs in Medford. So options out there to see if there is lead near you. I want to thank our guests for joining us today. We have a much greater understanding of lead, why it's out there, and how we can find it. Jim Shames is the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. Richard Roseberg is the director of Southern Oregon Research and Extension Center. And Lauren Herbert is a pediatrician at Peace Health in Eugene and a board member of Beyond Toxics. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
Okay.